It's nice to be here. And I think it's interesting that the first two presentations on this session were surveys, and a lot of the questions that people raised brought out the limitations of surveys. And so this is kind of the opposite direction of a more in-depth exploratory study that we did to study factors influencing glaucoma treatment adherence. And these are my co-authors, and I have no disclosures to make. We're from the Emory University Rollins School of Public Health, the Department of Ophthalmology at the School of Medicine at Emory, and the Atlanta VA Medical Center. Glaucoma is expected to occur in 60.5 million people worldwide by 2010, so that's not very far away. And the benefits of lowering intraocular pressure by medication and surgical intervention are well established. But certainly anecdotally and from a handful of studies, patient adherence to glaucoma treatment regimens is not very good, and we hear that, and most eye doctors that treat glaucoma patients will tell you that they're concerned about adherence and that eye drops are not always used, that people don't show up for appointments, people don't always refill their prescriptions. So that was the basis for this study. Of the studies that have been done, the factors that have been examined for the most part are the same as for treatment adherence with medication for chronic disease in general. They include provider-related factors, issues of trust and communication. Something we actually ran into again and again during our study is, how carefully chart notes are taken, how much the doctor talks to the patient about compliance issues and so forth. And as everyone knows, doctors are overloaded. They have limited time to spend with patients, so that feeds into that. As far as medication-related factors, oftentimes the regimens are complex. People have multiple medications to take, or they have comorbidities and they may be taking medications for other conditions besides their glaucoma. Some people have side effects, and the cost of medication is an obstacle to many people. My father in his 80s, who has glaucoma, complains about that, and a lot of patients with a lot less economic ability confront this. And then last are patient-related factors, and they overlap with medication factors as well, things such as manual dexterity, because glaucoma is a disease of aging, coordination, difficulty getting eye drops in, comprehension, remembering. One of the things we did early in the study was put out all the meds on the table in our conference room, and the writing on the patient inserts is kind of small, and it's kind of ironic since this is for low vision issues. And things such as social support, self-efficacy, people's confidence, because the condition is often asymptomatic until it progresses. Just like with high blood pressure, people cannot tell that the medicine is actually helping them, and so they have to believe that it does in order to use it. So our study objective was to advance our understanding of factors influencing treatment adherence for both medication taking, prescription refills, and also for appointment keeping. And most actively treated glaucoma patients have appointments about 4 times a year. The reason that we did this study was to help us develop an intervention for a clinical trial to improve glaucoma compliance, and we weren't satisfied that there was enough information in the literature to really guide us. And in particular, as you'll see, we were working with somewhat unique populations, and this was going to help us really to develop the intervention content. So we studied 80 participants from 2 eye clinics in the metropolitan Atlanta area, one being a public hospital, Grady Hospital, some of you may have heard of it, and the VA hospital. So 2 very different hospitals. The reason that we were involved with these 2 hospitals was because patients supposedly, I have to qualify that, got their medication from the hospital formularies and from the hospital pharmacies. So for instance, if we were to try to study patients at the Emory Eye Center, they're much more likely to be getting their medications in the community, and we wanted to get pharmacy cooperation and to be able to afford that. So we worked with these two settings. And they also have some other unique characteristics. We initially recruited through flyers in the eye clinic waiting rooms. We offered participants a small financial incentive to take part, but as we got along down the way, we found that most of the volunteers were actually people who were relatively high on their compliance. And so we then had to change, go back to our IRBs, and use chart reviews to identify people who had at least some presumptive non-compliance, because if you only talk to people who are compliant, you're really not going to get the answer here. So adherence was determined through self-report, interviews, as well as administrative data, clinic appointment and pharmacy refill data, as well as physician notes on non-adherence. I actually began working on patient compliance with medications back when I was in graduate school, which is a really long time ago. And administrative data sources are not that much better today. Even in places with electronic medical records, they're really problematic. So you really need to use multiple sources of information. And what we did was we interviewed the participants, and we eventually classified and coded their reasons by independent coders, and then compared the compliant and the non-compliant participants' answers. Eligibility criteria included being aged 18 to 80 years old, and as you'll see, they trended on the older side there. They were either white or African-American, because that's most of the population that received their care at our two study sites. They had to have a telephone, and they had to speak or understand English. They had to be diagnosed with open-angle glaucoma, glaucoma suspect, or ocular hypertension, and have been taking topical glaucoma medication for at least 12 months. In order to have a chance to miss your refills and miss your appointments, you know, you have to be on medication for a certain period of time. The interview asked about background characteristics, the usual suspects, socio-demographics, adherence, and facilitators and barriers to medication adherence, refill and clinic visits, as well as their medical knowledge, health literacy, and psychosocial factors such as self-efficacy attitudes and social support. We kept coming back to the question of operationalizing non-adherence. You know, what do you count when somebody's supposed to be taking drops multiple times a day or multiple drops? Does missing one drop equal non-compliance, or missing one appointment, and so forth? So what we did was we really looked at all of our possible sources. As far as medication, we looked at physician notes in the charts, self-report of missing at least one dose in a week. So we put the bar pretty low, knowing that people tend to under-report their non-compliance. As far as refills, we looked at the pharmacy records, people being at least 1 month lag in refill time, because often people get a little extra medication in case they run out or don't get their refills, and self-report of running out. And as far as clinic attendance, we had used the clinic records indicating missing an appointment and not rescheduling it in the past year, or a person's self-report of missing an appointment. So not we took non-adherence in any of these categories as an indicator of non-adherence. Our main analysis was to compare those who were adherent with those who were non-adherent, so look at which of these factors would distinguish the compliers from the non-compliers. Statistics, fairly simple, Pearson chi-square and Fisher's exact tests, and we set the p-value fairly conservative because of a relatively small sample. So we had 80 participants in the study, and these are their demographic characteristics. Basically, they were predominantly over age 60, and no difference between the two study sites. Not surprisingly, there was a difference in the gender mix. At the VA hospital, 95% were male, and 30% were male at the public hospital. We originally started out going into this study wanting to look at the difference between white and African American groups, but as you can see, we ended up with over 90% African Americans. We concluded that's not so bad, because this is a population that actually needs to be studied better. And it was a moderate to low educated population. And as you can see, the public hospital was much less educated than the VA hospital patients. 75% of them had only a high school education or less, whereas the veterans tended to be more likely to have completed college. These are some of the factors that distinguish the compliers from the non-compliers. The ones with the asterisks are the ones that were found significantly different. By and large, everybody trusted their eye doctor, over 90%. That was not really an issue. And a very small proportion said they would trust their general physicians the most. So these are glaucoma patients. But we found that those who were adherent felt that their doctors were more likely to say their doctor spent enough time with them and were more likely to go to their doctor if they had questions. They were also more likely to ask their pharmacist if they had questions. So the people who were adherent were probably more assertive in getting information if they had an issue about their glaucoma treatment. As far as the medication factors, again, almost everybody was taking other medications. Remember, this is a group, the average age over 60, so many of them will have other chronic conditions, whether cardiovascular, diabetes, arthritis, the whole gamut. The compliant people were more likely to have had their medications changed by their doctor recently, and this is kind of interesting because it may mean that they spoke up if they had a problem with the medication. We can't really tease out the causality there. There wasn't a difference in terms of the average number of glaucoma medications, and actually the adherent participants were more likely to say that they had some kind of a side effect. Again, so that didn't necessarily cause them to be non-adherent. As far as the significant patient factors, you can see that the non-adherent patients said that their schedules made it more difficult for them to take their medication. They weren't convinced of the benefits of taking glaucoma medication. They were less likely, it's kind of a double negative, less likely to say that there were no downsides, so they felt that there were more negatives to taking regular medication. The adherent group was much more likely to have somebody to help them to take their medication, to put the drops in their eyes, to drive them to their appointment. And last of all, it's kind of interesting, is that the non-adherent patients actually thought that their glaucoma was more likely to affect their eyesight in the future. There were many factors that did not distinguish the compliers from the non-compliers. A lot of attitudes, the belief that in general that the medication would be useful in preventing blindness, reducing pressure, and so forth, and a lot of general characteristics in terms of social support, somebody to help them with their condition or remind them about their appointments. Other non-significant patient factors included their belief that glaucoma would affect their daily tasks, their emotional reaction to having glaucoma, and some various miscellaneous factors as well. So we looked at a lot of different factors, and these were ones that did not differ between the groups. There are certainly limitations to this study, as to any study. And when you see the long list of factors that didn't distinguish, there's statistical consideration of having multiple significance tests, relatively small sample size, and our participants were relatively homogeneous, at least within the two clinic populations. The findings are consistent with the literature that is published to date. Some of the big things that come out as issues are challenges in administering drops, memory, remembering to take drops and to take them on their schedule, and social support, having help, although there's less documentation of that in the literature, particularly. Our next steps and where we are right now in the study had to do with developing the intervention, and we're currently enrolling participants into our randomized trial. What we're using is IVR technology, which is the automated voice technology that we all know and love so much when we try to make plane reservations and everything else. But actually, one of the reasons for doing this is that it could potentially be disseminated widely if it is effective in improving compliance. So we're providing individually tailored messages based on the baseline surveys of the participants who are randomized to the treatment group to provide them with knowledge and to intervene on their specific barriers that are individual, not just the global barriers that we found in this study. And we're also following up the phone calls, the series of phone calls, with print materials. And the print materials are to follow up and reinforce. We don't expect people to be taking notes on the phone calls, reinforce the tips and strategies, and to provide those so that people can review them. And also in case people miss the call, because we know not everybody will be able to be reached, even though we will try persistently. And we have this automated system that will be doing that. I want to acknowledge some of our other participants in the National Eye Institute. Thank you. Yes. Yeah, they were all, there was very little cost issue and very little cost to them to pay for their medications, so that's somewhat taken out of the mix. We did find that although supposedly everybody is getting their medications directly from the VA or from the Grady Pharmacy, that people do get them from other sources. They get them from CVS. Sometimes they might get them on another family member's. But by and large, that was taken out of the equation. The bigger issues are things like waiting time, which was a huge issue for appointments in the public hospital. Right. And to add to that, at the VA hospital, they actually have kind of a push system where they just dial in and their medications are sent to them. And if they don't call in by a certain time, the VA will call them. I mean, it doesn't guarantee that everybody gets it, but it certainly is a type of administrative intervention that's already there.
I think it's fairly well established that the rate of adherence is proportional to the number of medications that an individual is on. I think your study may have shown that as well. My question is in regards to the attitudes and opinions both of the providers as well as the patients of switching from eye drops, which for a variety of reasons, obviously among elders, are difficult to self-administer, to oral medications, especially among people with coexisting hypertension, whether that was an intervention to improve compliance in people on multiple medication regimens.
From what I understand, and I rely on my ophthalmology collaborators for this, drops are still by far and away the dominant mode of treatment, and it's not commonly considered that to improve compliance that they should be switched to oral meds. At least that's the current state of the art as they describe it.
Yes, but it may not be because of the state of the art. It may be because of the 50 patients a day and the ability.
It could be. I mean, I guess from what I've been told is they're not generally saying, oh, gosh, an oral med would do just as well for this patient. That generally the ophthalmologists.
Say, let's take them off their topical beta blocker, and then you can reduce the pharmacy at the same time.
Oh, that's really going out on a limb, having doctors talk to each other.
We'll take one more question.
Okay. I think it comes from the National Eye Institute.
Okay. Let me ask this question. Do you know your mean age of your population is relatively young. 62.5 years is relatively young.
It was, give or take 10 or 11 years.
Of that percentage, do you know what number or what percentage are greater than 70 years old? What percentage of your population are greater than 70 years old?
I think it was about a quarter that were over 70.
This doesn't take into consideration patients who are not ambulatory, who are in skilled care or in a
Right, these are all ambulatory patients, correct.
Thank you. You want to stay up front here?
Sure.
So we have about 10 minutes left for general questions, so I would invite you to obviously tell who you're asking the question to, and then it's just open for questions at this point. Yes?
I had a question for Karen. It was interesting, when you looked at how you define non-adherence, you had kind of more subjective responses and more objective responses.
Right.
So maybe you didn't present it, but I was wondering how much those correlated. You know, someone said that they, in fact, missed an appointment. Was it documented that they missed?
You know, we really wanted to be able to do that analysis. What happens is there are so many gaps in the medical charts, in the pharmacy charts, and in the appointment charts. Even the VA, which uses an electronic medical record, they don't use it in ophthalmology because the eye docs are not satisfied that the graphics are good enough for them. At a place like a public hospital, you have to manually go through the appointment records, and you're mixing in glaucoma with other eye conditions in the vision clinic. So there are a lot of gaps. When we would go back, because we have two eye docs on our team that both work in low vision and glaucoma clinics, and we'd say, well, how come there's no chart notes in all these records? They said, well, the residents were in a hurry. Yeah. So not having chart notes doesn't mean that they don't have a compliance problem. And they could actually, you know, tell us what some of those patterns were. So it's very difficult to tease it out.
Yes?
I have a question for Dr. Scarborough. When you were saying that there were X percentage of primary care physicians who were saying to their patients that, you know, it's important for you to get an eye exam, was there ever documented a follow-up where the physicians went ahead and talked to their patients? And because when you go to a physician, they're given so much information that a lot of times patients are not going to remember everything that's being said. And when the doctor, primary care doctor, is just going to mention, you know, it's important for you to get your eyes checked.
Whether or not they do it, sure.
No. Yeah, because they're going to go back to the physician anyway. So follow up is, did you really go for your eye exam?
No, that question wasn't asked. In the national study that we did of adults, asking them about follow-up, did they follow up after somebody had made a recommendation? We did ask in that study, and this one, since it was really at one level was out of our control, exactly how many questions could get put in. That's, again, another great question and something that we'd like to see in the future asked. Ask about follow-up. There are a number of additional questions that we'd like to see, and maybe this next year, for the Doc Style survey that Port and Valley does, we can incorporate some of these and actually get to some of these.
Yes?
I wanted to ask Dr. Berman a policy question. Among both the model law that has been developed as well as the New Jersey legislation that's been introduced, is vision insurance in schools for participants in high-risk sports mandated? In other words, is it a prerequisite that they have vision insurance in order to just get on the team? And would that be something that the schools would pay for?
No. I mean, there's no prerequisite in terms of them having to have vision insurance. One of the things that we want to start looking at, though, is, for example, Dixie Baseball mandated protective face shields, and their insurance premium went down 53%. So there might be a liability issue. You know, I know in the racquetball courts of New Jersey, we have to wear protective eyewear, either plano or with prescription. They won't let you on the court in these private facilities, and it's really an insurance mandate. So that's another way to potentially go, is to speak to people involved in risk management.
So are you suggesting that there's a history of individuals suing the facility for not enforcing protective eyewear only on our courts?
I think it's more healthcare costs. You know, if somebody has an eye injury, though, and it occurs in the school and their insurance company will sue to cover the insurance.
So it's a matter of suing the school submits enough so that then they mandate insurance in advance.
Well, no, it's not a negligence suit. It's a suit that, what happens is if your child's playing even after school sport and they get injured, the school insurance carrier will pay for the medical cost of that injury.
So shouldn't that same carrier therefore provide prophylactic, preventative?
I think there might be a case to be made that it's cost effective I'm actually confident that it would be cost effective to mandate protective eyewear, because eye injuries are tragic and expensive.
Any other questions? I have a question for Karen. In terms of, you mentioned as one of the limitations the many tests that were done. And as somebody who's done a little bit but not a lot of formative research, which I think is a really important thing in this type of area, how do you balance choosing your p-value, which was actually set fairly generously, with the multiple tests, given that it's formative research to inform an intervention rather than, you know, research where you're trying to draw firm conclusions about things? And how do those trade-offs change? Because, you know, we're so used to thinking of p less than 0.05 and minimizing the number of tests. And I guess the biggest question would be, was there anything where the p-value was greater than 0.05 but less than 0.1 that ended up playing a big role in the way the intervention is planned?
Well, because the intervention is going to be tailored, it added kind of another variable into the mix. So we didn't want to throw something out if there was even a, you know, kind of a trend in that direction. So that was our thinking. But in the intervention, it's actually going to be based on individuals' responses. Mm. And in the randomized trial, we're only including non-compliant individuals because, you know, to do a randomized trial with people who are already compliant would not be worth it. So we're just kind of allowing it because you have to, with this type of intervention, you actually have to create the scripts and the voices and so forth. And we don't want to end up, you know, not having anything to say to an individual. So that's a good
Got it. Thank you. Any final questions? Well, thank you all for coming to this session.